It's not the most conducive environment for an everyday work. I remember one day I had this theory that if my hat blew off three times, it was time I went back to the house. And if the dog jumped into the front of the ute instead of jumping onto the back of the ute, it was also time. The environment, to me, I love it. I love that. But to a lot of women, no, it's a threat. It's uncomfortable. It's dirty. But there's more women stepping up now, your age, and doing all those things. It blows me away. And it gives me a lot of... I'm grateful for those women stepping up.
Welcome to Herstory, an RTRFM podcast series exploring the lives, careers and successes of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll be with you each week as we hear stories from some of the trailblazing women who've left their mark on the world. This week, we head to the great southern region of Western Australia with 2020 inductee Marg Agnew. After growing up on the family orchard in country Victoria, Marg set off for Western Australia to be with her husband Rob, arriving about 8 hours southeast of Perth near Newdigate. Battling high interest rates to the tune of 23%, living in a caravan without power, and not knowing many folks in WA, Marg began her new life as a newland farmer. Throughout her career, she sat on dozens of committees, investigated the relationship between conservation and farming, and eventually established the state's first rural and remote women's magazine.
Marg Agnew, farm partner, partner in farming. I've reflected over the years and I just realised how fortunate I was to have been born and grow up on the family orchard in rural Victoria. Because I love space, I love being involved in agriculture. I mean, I was so comfortable. I would walk the orchard, I'd follow my dad around when we were irrigating. And my three sisters, I don't know what they were doing, but I guess they were inside. So really, from the very start, I was in the right place.
You were out on the grounds.
Yes, I was footprints everywhere, gumboots. It was so comfortable. Our house was right in the middle of the orchard. And to see the seasons with autumn and winter and spring and the fruit and then be involved. Our school holidays, our summer school holidays, were spent working in the shed grading fruit. And I must have been very close to my dad anyway, but I worked with my father across, we worked across from one another. So I was happy. It was school holidays, but I was doing what I loved doing.
That's so lovely that you have such strong, and some of, I imagine, some of your first memories of those real family home kind of things for you.
I look back on, I think, how lucky was I that I was in a place where I was comfortable and felt useful. Yeah.
What is it that you love so much about being out on the farm or being out on a big piece of land?
There's something about the space, although it's interesting now, in orchards, you only ever see the sky. And the one thing about moving to the west and being a broadacre farmer, I can see the horizon. So I've had the best of both worlds, of being in amongst irrigation and the green and coming to WA and where it's brown and this enormous space and our beautiful native wildlife and flora and fauna. I enjoy the space, and probably some of my best thinking was done on a tractor where there was no interference, no visitors, no phone calls, and I'd have my light bulb moments.
You've truly cracked that, like, moment in peace and serenity thing, being
yes.
on a tractor.
Yeah.
That's fabulous.
I mean, I love it. Other people, they would miss security of being close to other people, but to me, mine's the opposite. I quite enjoy my own company, and I'm always thinking ahead and planning and looking at the environment or our farm and trying to work out ways we can improve it.
What kind of orchard was your family orchard?
Our main product was canning fruit for the SPC.
It's real fruit, just like the fruit you pick fresh from the tree.
So we started off with apricots, and then we'd go to peaches, we had plums, and we had pears, and we had apples. So the season started in about November and went through to nearly the end of March.
I don't know if this is a silly question because I've not spent any time on an orchard, but did you just have delicious baked goods all the time?
No, we used to use, we were very probably forward with having cooked fruit with meat.
Ooh.
So, you know, the normal apple sauce with pork.
Sure.
But we would have baked pears with lamb, baked peaches. So we had it that way, yeah.
That's cutting edge.
Yeah.
I like that. Do you still do it now?
I still do it now and people go, no, you have your pear and your peach with your sweets. And I'm going, no.
This is the retro revival before it was retro.
Yep. I love that.
So beautiful lush green surrounds at the family orchard.
Yes.
Obviously, like you've mentioned, a little bit different here in Western Australia, far more brown and red dirt. Yes. How did you end up over on the West Coast?
Well, my husband, Rob, he came from the same region and he'd moved over in the 60s with his family to become what they called then Newland Farmers. So he came back for my sister's wedding to be a groomsman and I was the bridesmaid. And so for 3 years we saw one another once a year when he came back for another wedding, and the chemistry was right. And so I hooked up to a caravan, came to the West, and fortunately with youth and romance and just the excitement of something new, that's how I landed up in WA.
And what part of WA was that?
Rob's property was located at Newdigate. That was what they call a conditional purchase property. But his family were in Esperance. They were farming in Esperance, and we were 3 to 4 hours away. We couldn't get an overdraft because we had no assets. So the cost of freighting all our inputs like fertiliser and fuel to the farm from Esperance, and then the grain that we produced had to be freighted back to Esperance. And I remember the last year we were there, the cost of the freight for the grain, we could have bought a new Fairlane car. So we decided that we would move. The Americans were opening up land, virgin bush land in Esperance. So we bought that and moved to Esperance. Just mainly because we're near the port and near the services.
Mm. What is a Newland farmer?
Probably in the 60s, the government started to open up land to increase the area of farming. And so they had properties that probably in those days was say 1,000 to 1,500 acres. And you then applied. It was nothing to do with money. I don't know whether it was a ballot system, but that's what it was. And then you had to pay so much back each year. I think the sad part about the system, there was no restrictions on what you cleared. So it was broadacre clearing. And on reflection, I think some of that we probably could have left more vegetation there. So we were more or less removing the native vegetation and then clearing that, which was quite a challenge in those days. We didn't have the equipment we've got today. And then starting to grow crops and fence it and run livestock.
And farm.
Yes.
Start a new farm. Yes. That transitional, that move to regional Western Australia to start a farm, not just work at or inherit a farm, would be quite a shock to a lot of people. Coming from a farming background, was that an easy transition to the West Coast?
Oh, I just slipped in like hand in a glove. I think I've always enjoyed the challenge of our lifestyle, and this was a really big challenge. And I was learning just in the need for learning more about broadacre. The rawness of it was a challenge because when we arrived, we were living in a caravan, we had no power. We would hook the battery up to a car for a light at night. We had no hot water, we had no toilet, we had no shower.
So you had to really love each other.
Being the domestic goddess I am, I worked my way through and I finally got an outside wood stove to boil water, and I got some cement and made a shower base and got a port-a-loo. So
you did all those things?
I helped. Yes, I can remember doing the cementing for the shower base.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Quite literally starting from the ground up.
Yes, yeah. From scratch. Yeah. Well, there was no option. And all the neighbours and people around us were in the same position. So it wasn't like you were looking over the fence at a neighbour and going, oh, I wish I was like that particular farmer. We were all in the same boat. We were young. We had nothing to lose. We had nothing to lose.
Is that the farm that you still live at now?
No. Well, what happened was we had that farm and then we moved to Espence, but we took on the same challenge again of clearing a farm. We had to clear one third of the farm a year. Unfortunately, at the time, 23% interest is what we were paying on our overdraft, which was quite small, and our loans that we were getting for development. And that really took the fun out of it, because you wanted to fence the boundary, put internal fences in for livestock, build dams, you know, for water storage, and then sheds for equipment, let alone a house. Mm. So, all we could manage each year was paying the interest. So, but it just made you value the dollar. Every time you wanted to buy something, you just felt that there was no luxuries. It was essential.
And having a real appreciation, I imagine, for being able to make things yourself and self-start.
Yep, make my son's all his clothing. And I've just been in the stores today looking at what you can buy, and I'm thinking we can survive without a lot of things, but it does make life comfortable if you do have them.
Or shiny. Pretty. Yes. Okay, so you come here, you cement your shower, you hook your caravan up, start clearing bushland. When you get your first crops going, what are they? What's it look like for you?
If you drive out to the wheat belt today, they're nothing like the crops. We were still learning how to farm the soil. It was sand, what we call silicon sand, so it's sort of the water runs off it. It had been under the sea, so there was no nutrients there. And so it took us a couple of years to find out what fertilisers were applicable for that. But look, we were happy with the first harvest. It wasn't a lot, but I think that was the learning of how to farm this new country, yes.
Where or when do you learn how to become a farmer?
Well, you ask like-minded people, the farmers that you admire. You ask resalers what they're recommending. I love reading rural magazines, so I was forever reading. There weren't many field days available to attend at that time, but if there was, I was there. It was a matter of asking questions. More or less every year you're doing a trial, you were learning, and each year you would gain some knowledge and you'd think, well, we'll repeat that. Or if it didn't work, well, you know, we tried it. So it was just trial and error. Didn't matter about the income, whether that... No, it was every year you just wanted to do better than the last year, yeah.
I like the idea of there being not necessarily a competition amongst other farmers, but more of like a collaboration almost.
Oh, I think what is undervalued in the farming community compared to maybe retail is the freedom of information. Farmers are very generous with sharing what they've done and their mistakes. I remember when we first went into livestock, and I'd never owned a sheep in my life, and I knew that you had to, give them vaccines. So I asked six neighbouring farmers, what should I do? And I got six answers. So that was then the challenge of saying, well, which farmer, which one do I follow? So you can get the information and then it's being discerning and trying to work out what's applicable to your situation. But we are blessed that industry, we're not competing against one another. We're all trying, we've got our own business and we're trying to do the best job. But we are very, very generous with sharing information.
When you say six neighbouring farmers, at the time, and even now, what does that look like? Is it still very much men running farms? When you were starting in Western Australia, who else was farming around then?
I guess a lot of us were young, so a lot of women were involved in the house with just looking after the children, running them to the bus stop. Even then and today, visibility, it's probably still quite male-dominated. And that's not anything wrong with the industry. I guess in the early days, and I'm going back 100 years, it was a brawn and brain industry. We didn't have the machinery. If I wanted to lift things, I would, do a stepping process. I mean, I was determined, so no one was around. But now with the machinery we have, with hydraulics and technology, anybody can, run the farm with the amazing machinery we have today. And more women have now stepped up and are working those machinery and are taking over the farm. So there's been a generational change with the generation of seeing daughter or daughters that are wanting to come home, and there's an acceptance now that they can take over the farm. So it's been quite liberating to see where it was traditional for the son to take over. Now it's really amazing to see the women that are given that opportunity, if they're daughters, to take over the family farm.
You have sisters, Yama.
Yes, yes.
So have any of them taken over your family orchard, or is the orchard still in the family?
Oh, no. Unfortunately, my dad died suddenly at 47 and we sold the orchard. But I'll just go back a little bit. When I was in secondary school, I wanted to attend Burnley Horticultural College, and I suggested that to my mum, and I don't think she heard me. It was like, girls in the 60s, you're a nurse or a teacher. And so the seed was there for me.
Did you just make an apple joke? Sorry.
So I did office management for a year and was bored stiff. The only thing I used today is keyboard skills. That was the only thing I got out of it. My sisters, no, they went on and did nursing and teaching. And yes.
They did the good thing that girls in the 60s did.
They made mum and dad happy, yes. And I did too.
I was going to say, I'm sure, you know, moving across the country and starting your own farm is pretty impressive.
Yes, yes. That also makes you resilient, having no family. A lot of us don't have family here. A lot of us came from the eastern seaboard. And even to this day, you know, we've had to grow our own families around us. And our friendships are like families. Yeah.
I love that idea of the farming community sharing and collaborating in the work, but also in the actual family fundamentals too.
Yes.
What does a typical day, I mean, you're in Perth right now, but when you go home, what will a typical day be like for you, Mark?
Okay, well, we've downsized and we've only got a small, what they call hobby farm, but I'm finding it the hobby farm is fairly full on for me. Well, this time of the year, we would be selling prime lambs, and so I would probably muster the mob in the morning, weigh the lambs and put them into a mob. We might put them into three grades of weights. Depending on the weather, we might have made a decision this time of the year. The wheat crop might need a fungicide on it, which would weather check, and my husband would go, right, the wind's dropped. Yep, I'll spray this afternoon. You know, so there's some jobs that have to be done and there's some jobs that we would like to do, and then the weather probably is the biggest predictor of how we spend our day. So at the start of the week, we plan what we need to achieve within the week, and then it drops down whatever the weather does. So it's always outside. Monday morning for me is in the office, and I'm quite happy to do that. But after I've spent a morning in the office, I'm waiting for some sunshine and wind in my hair.
What sort of hours are we talking here? What's like a start on clock on time?
For me, it was probably only 8 o'clock in the morning. So, but when we're mustering or shearing, it's usually 5:30, 6:00. And then probably 6:30 in the afternoon I'd come in. Yeah, probably daylight hours for me. At harvest time, I'd be working with harvest. I'd say to my husband about 10:30 at night, I've had enough, but now a lot of the farmers work through the night. But there was just the two of us, so in summertime it'd be probably 5:00.
Sure.
5 o'clock, sun's up, do some watering at home, check the sheep, and then be in the paddock all day and come home.
Some long hours on your feet.
Well, you have to.
Yeah. I'm learning this about farming, yes.
The one thing of looking back on being involved in horticulture in Victoria, I couldn't go back to that again because of so much damage can be done to ripe fruit. At least with, say, wool on a sheep's back, we could be 2 or 3 weeks late with shearing and the wool quality won't change. And the same with grain. We don't mind a little bit of rain when the crop is ripe, but we don't want too much either. So the broadacre farming's a little bit more forgiving when we're harvesting than what horticulture is.
When you say farm, I'm sure there are people out there who are going, oh, yeah, farm, big paddocks, sheep, cows, or, you know, the wheat belt, nice big long crops of wheat.
Yes.
But there is so much variation in farming.
When I was involved with our land care group and I got to know my neighbours and farmers in my district really well because we'd meet monthly. And the one thing that I realised with our conversations, because we're all trying to overcome this issue of salinity, their involvement, their attention to detail, and I realised they are just different. You look at a street in Perth and you think, well, we're all different. You know, there's a policeman, there's a nurse, there's an office worker, whatever. And the farmers are the same. We labelled, but we are so individual and so is our farms.
Mm.
As I said to you before about learning about how to look after sheep, and I got six different answers, I think that explains the individuality. And that's why I think it is an exciting industry, because we are providing food for the next step of manufacturing, but we have a lot of freedom about how we do it. We all end up with the same result, but we all have a different recipe. I think it's often taken for granted by ourselves, the freedom we have. I mean, we have a lot of restrictions now, social licence, making sure that, you know, what we're doing is acceptable by the end user. And that is taken as a given now, and we're all very conscious of that. But individual, the machinery they buy, the how, why they make that decision, how they use that machinery, they're all different. And I love them for it.
Yeah, no two farms alike.
No, they're not. And even within a family with two brothers or two daughters that are sons or whatever running it, I think it must be some interesting roundtable conferences when you've got a big family, because each individual will have their plan of how we should plant the crop this year, but you could end up with six different ways of times of the year of when we start, what we'll use.
Mm.
It's fascinating.
Never ending.
Yes.
A large part of your work, Marg, includes maintaining sustainable preservation of land, and you mentioned there about salinity. Can you tell us a bit about what that means?
Going back to my history of a settling in Esperance, and I felt that there weren't any restrictions put on us with clearing the land. We had to clear one third a year, and there was already natural salt lakes there. So within a decade of us clearing the land, so you're taking away the natural trees and shrubs in the environment, and then you're planting what we call annual crops, which is your wheat and barley and lupins and canola. So therefore you haven't got the plants using that moisture all year when the rain falls. So what happened after about a decade, we started to notice the salt lakes were expanding and the low-lying areas started to fill up with water because we weren't using it with our annual crops. And then with time, the salinity happened. And also at that time, the decade of land care started a nationwide project. We had no knowledge, and it's really quite sad that the government knew that salinity was happening in the wheat belt in the 40s, but that land probably on reflection, I mean, it's fabulously productive now, but at that time I often doubted whether the land should have been opened up for farming. And probably for the next decade, I whipped myself without knowledge, thinking that I'd created the problem. But that was the beauty of our land care group. We'd meet every month with the local people in our catchment, and we'd invite speakers from the Department of Agriculture, or at the time CALM, who had that knowledge, and they told us how it was created and how we could go about solving it. So when I became more knowledgeable about solution, then I got into trying to solve the problem.
One of those solutions was planting 140,000 trees.
Mm.
Can you paint a picture? What does that look like when you put 140,000 trees on your property?
You see where the issue is. It's usually low-lying areas that are creating water. So therefore, what I learned over time was there seemed to be a practice of you plant trees around the salt and that will be right. But really the moisture was coming higher up in the landscape. So therefore, I targeted those sand ridges, which often were prone to erosion with wind. I mean, there's now remedial ways to solve that today. There was just, as you drove down the middle of our farm, there'd be on the left or the right, a block of trees.
And you hand planted them?
No, I planted them, but we had a machine that I sat on. My husband would drive the tractor, and I remember one day it was raining, and I had weatherproof trousers on and about two rain jackets and a hat. And my husband said, "Now, come on, let's stop." And I said, "Look, I've played golf, and that's what, you know, if it was a rainy day, I'd be playing golf." So I really love planting trees.
That's good, because you've got 140,000 of
them.
Yeah.
And at the time, we were planting native vegetation, and then the oil mallee industry started, and that was so that because of farmers planting so many trees, we were trying to find a way of value-adding those trees. So I got involved with the oil mallee industry, and the idea was to allow the tree to grow, and then you would cut it down, harvest the leaf and make oil. And that is still happening in Killarney today, but it didn't quite take off in our region. So you felt a little bit better about the trees, thinking, well, they're going to be doing water use, but they're also may be able to provide another product that we can harvest on the farm. So that was my selling point to my husband.
To plant all of the trees in the pouring rain. I want to speak more on sustainable aspects of farming in a moment, but you mentioned just before, when you were thinking about the salinity and the growing of those salt lakes over the decade, that you felt like you might have had something to do with that. And you didn't use the word guilt, but I imagine with so much time on your own, there's sometimes things that are unavoidable.
Yes.
What is the relationship between farming and mental health? The idea of just thinking about what you're doing and if it doesn't quite, the crop isn't quite successful, what that might have an impact on?
Well, with me, it was guilt. I think that's why I've got out and about. It's that lack of information and knowledge, because the more you can learn, then you can understand what the problem is and then find a solution for it. But I really, for a decade, I was quite obsessive. And I did, as I said, whip myself quite a bit that I'd created the problem. And I was so disappointed because so much work had gone into clearing the land, and that it seemed quite ironic that, you know, then we're planting trees back into landscape.
So that's where the Neradup Soil group. Conservation Group comes from?
Yes.
So it's a way for education, but it's also a way just to make sure, you know, check in on everyone, make sure everyone's okay too.
Yes. We're all in it together. And I think one of the beauties of being in a group of like-minded people with the same problem is that we would have field walks in the morning from about 8 till 10, and we'd go to different farms each month. And the beauty of that was that you could see other farmers had a worse problem than you did. There were some that didn't have a problem or didn't have a major problem. But yes, you sort of came away saying, oh my God, my farm isn't as bad. It isn't as...
Sure.
It hasn't got as big a problem as what they have.
So. You're able to offer help to those who need it too.
Yes.
Was anything like that around prior to maybe like the establishment of those kinds of groups with you?
No, there wasn't. I suppose because it was such a young industry and people were just so busy working, really, and they are today. And we hadn't built those networks through Fire Brigade meeting at the bus run. It was very raw and young, and I think that's why at the time the establishment of our group was successful, was it was the first time that as a community with the same sort of soil, rainfall, just the children all knew each other from going to the local school, it brought us together. So we used to have this 2 hours of meeting and 2 hours of supper. And, you know, we'd start at 8 and I'd say goodbye to them at 12 o'clock at night. And that's where I think that mental side of it was, I won't say there was a mental problem, but if there was, at least there was 2 hours where the members could just relax. There was a lot of laughter. Every year I'd have a birthday cake for another year of achievement. So a lot of fellowship. And I learnt, as I said to you before, I learnt a lot about farmers individually and how individual they are. So I'm really grateful for that experience.
One of the things that you've been pretty steadfast in is advocating for women in agriculture and women in farming.
Yes.
When you were farming, when you first started, were there many other women doing that?
No. And I never thought anything of it at the time because I was, I won't say driven, but so enthusiastic and hungry for information, I would attend And there was a lot of forums, field days, workshops, and even today I'm often the only woman there. Sometimes I'd be invisible. I've just been thinking about it, and the men did have trouble talking to me because I don't think they understood my depth of knowledge. So if I did have a conversation, I would have to explain my problem, but I would have to explain it deeper than a male to male. So I'd have to prove that I knew my subject, I had facts and figures, and therefore I proved my credibility, and then I could have that dialogue.
It sounds exhausting just to have to establish yourself before you can actually get down to the nitty-gritty.
But if there was a particular person that I knew was advanced in some sort of technology or change or development, and I wanted to, you know, share my thoughts and get feedback, and it was worth the investment of my time, yeah.
So you're sometimes the only woman in the room.
Yes.
You have, like we just mentioned, you've started land care groups. You've also been a member of over 20 state, national, local boards and committees. What is it about showing up and being on all of those committees and boards, which, by the way, the admin must be a lot for that? Why is it important that you continue to show up and be that woman in the room if there's no other women in the room?
Well, with my involvement with a lot of committees over a few decades, I've been very fortunate that I've been tapped on the shoulder or the phone's rung for me. So I guess that reflects on my attendance and being visible. It's just my enthusiasm. And really, even today, I'll be honest, there's not a lot of women I can have a really deep and meaningful conversation about a lot of the detail of everyday farming life. Mm-hmm. And I'm completely uncomfortable with that. I was fortunate that I found my career path. And a lot of women, you know, have come from a career background. And the beautiful thing today is technology. They might be able to run their business still using technology, or they work in town, or they're very happy in the office doing the administration. So I've never had an expectation that there should be more, because I think we should be enjoying what we're doing.
Do you feel like, and I mean, you just mentioned that there's no expectation for there to be more women in farming.
No.
Is there a reason that you think there are less women in farming then?
Well, I think the environment isn't friendly. I mean, you know, we're working in heat, cold, rain, wind. It's not the most conducive environment for an everyday work. I remember one day I had this theory that if my hat blew off three times, it was time I went back to the house. And if the dog jumped into the front of the ute instead of jumping onto the back of the ute, it was also time. So the environment, to me, I love it. I love that. But to a lot of women, no, it's a threat. It's uncomfortable. It's dirty. But there's more women stepping up now, your age, and doing all those things. It blows me away. And it gives me a lot of, I'm grateful for those women stepping up.
You mentioned before in the earlier days that farms were maybe inherited, sons would take over from their fathers.
Yes.
Do you think maybe people looking at it more so from your perspective, Marg, of looking more with a sustainability lens and thinking, how can we continue to keep our farming industry alive and stable, but also paying close attention to the environment? Is that a way, or is that a new avenue for people to get into farming?
Well, I think if I go back to our land care days and trying to understand what salinity was, it's always been there. It's just the media and the broader community have taken an interest. We are very precious about our soil. Our soil is the foundation of the farm, whether we're growing crops, fruit, livestock. And the evolution that's happened with how we care for our soil and improve it and make it sustainable, I'm in awe of today's farmers. We've got more machinery, we've got more knowledge, technology, testing. I think we do bring a caring role, but that doesn't take it away from the boys that are also very mindful of looking after their soil.
The Rural, Remote and Regional Women's Network for WA, can you tell us what that is?
In this conversation, we'll talk about it as Triple R, because that's what we ended up using it.
Excellent.
As I started on a journey where I was receiving rural women's magazines or newsletters from the Eastern Seaboard, and one particular article resonated with me and I had empathy with it. And it just was one of those light bulb moments when I thought, why hasn't WA got a magazine like this? So that started my two-year journey, and I lobbied all the rural politicians. I wrote to all the women that I'd met throughout the state with my different interests and asked them for support, and it was overwhelming. They just said, well, I'd presented a newsletter we'd published in Esperance for when we had a dry year, and I used that as an example. And the replies, I cried, was, when is the next newsletter coming out? We want more of these. So then I went to government, to three government departments, asking them for funding, and two government departments supported it. And so that was launched in August 1996, and our first 24-page full-colour magazine came out December 1996. And I think we had about 4,000 subscribers. There was a need, and one of the things that we had was it was free 4 times a year, and all stories, contributions were written by rural and remote and regional women. We didn't pay them for it. They supplied the photos. So they were genuine, literally unedited stories of women in regional towns or pastoral country towns, yeah.
Did you know there was an appetite for it?
Along my journey, when I was trying to build a support group, that's when I found... I never got one negative comment saying, you know, this is a waste of time, or no, I'll be interested. I was determined anyway, but having that support from, you know, male politicians and rural women.
And what about can you tell us about the significance of being able to reflect back to other women in the regions their own stories?
Yes. Myself being involved in agriculture, it is a very isolating industry. I worked on my own most days. We had two properties, so often my husband would be on another. So... And women like to talk. We love to communicate. And we don't get much chance except over the dinner table at night. And then even our shopping trips were quick. You know, you popped in, got what you needed, and you were home. So I felt that my feelings and my loss of not having family with me and my isolation, it must be felt across, you know, right up to the Kimberleys. And I think that's what resonated with, and I'm not saying this was for people on farms, because we had a lot of subscribers actually coming from the city who were rural women that had retired to the city, but they still wanted to be connected to the bush or where they'd come from. And we had a lot of men subscribe to our magazine as well.
That speaks volumes about the community, the regional community, and the connection that people share.
Yeah, and I think it was to show, like, empathy. And the other thing I wanted out of it was inspiration, and that's when technology was, you know, being rolled out in rural communities, and to see women that had careers and they'd moved to rural WA, or they wanted to start a business, they could read about other women that were doing, you know, set up something in their garage, or they were attending shows with products, and it was being able to mobilise that information, get it out there so that they could say, well, someone else is doing it. So it gave them freedom and inspiration to have a go themselves. And I think I loved seeing that bloom of women that had these skills and we weren't tapping into them. But by showcasing it and giving them encouragement, that was really rewarding.
Giving them 24 glossy pages. What's the Triple R doing now? Is it still running?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the magazine isn't. I think I added up it was about 18 years and about 73 editions was produced. And then one of the governments we had decided that they would stop publishing magazines and newsletters across a lot of departments. There was a board, I wasn't involved at the time, but there was a board with Triple R. They were given some seed money and then they were made a not-for-profit organisation. So today, they probably their theme is leadership and having forums for women to come together with speakers. So it's still going. I must admit, I do miss The magazine.
The sentiment's still there, which is fabulous.
Yes, yeah. But I can understand today with social media and all the different things that are available, maybe just replicating what would be in a hard copy.
I want to touch on a little bit less of the industry side, although it does still obviously fall heavily on this next set of questions. And they talk about your accolades and your awards, which I know nobody likes talking about. But I just want to touch on them because it is significant. It is part of the reason that we're having this conversation. Your work has definitely not gone unnoticed. You are a life member and the first female to be this life member for the WA Farmers Federation. What was it like when you get the phone call or the letter or the email of being like, hey, we'd like you to be a lifetime member?
Well, I was actually at their annual conference when it was announced. And I must admit, with all the awards that I've received, I still pinch myself. I'm not embarrassed. I'm humbled. I truly am humbled that my industry has recognised me, because I've just loved my journey and whatever I've achieved, it's been for agriculture and the broader community. But I am very grateful and thankful.
It's a real nice feeling. I can't believe they sprung it on you, though, at the conference. They didn't tell you prior?
No.
Okay.
No.
How do you react in that moment?
You seem to fumble your way through it with tears and a smile, but, very gratifying. Yeah.
Nick off to the bathroom when that one's being announced next time. What does it kind of look like now for you? Are you called upon to weigh in on boards still, or are you part of a few committees still?
I think the sad part was we sold our property in 2012. More or less immediately, I was invisible. And I think it's really sad on our society that you are pigeonholed and labelled without you knowing it. And it was like, oh, well, she's not interested. She's moved on. I've still got a hobby farm and I run a flock of merino sheep, and I had lambing this year and I love it. I just could not go into suburbia just yet. But it probably was 12 months I grieved for the loss of not the recognition, acceptance, or just that I was dismissed. And then in time, I think there was an understanding that I was still wanting to be active. So I had to be quiet, but still there. So I'm still on local committees. But there's also that realisation that as you get older, and I've got a lot of young friends, I've got to stand by and allow the next generation to take my seat at the table. So it's a bit of a, you get torn about still contributing, and I can still contribute, but I've also got to be there, I won't say as a mentor, but as support and encourage women and men, the next generation, because they're going to be the leaders. And so I'm comfortable with that.
Is that like a common thing that happens in farming when you maybe retire or sell a property? I mean, if that's been your entire life in that community, is that common when people maybe get aged out of the industry?
I think it's okay if you, with my husband, he was ready to walk and he was happy, whereas I did miss that full-on farming life. I'm not sure. I haven't discussed. I think most people retire and they've more or less said, shut the gate and I've had enough. I'm probably not the norm. So, you know, some of my best friends are farmers and I still want to know how much rain have you had and what are you doing and what are some of the issues. I know it's society across the board, but it is a shame because there's a lot of knowledge that is there that perhaps isn't being utilised. But on the other hand, you know, change is happening all the time and we've got to think, you know, 10, 20 years ahead, and those younger farmers have that depth of need to be involved and we've got to be there to support them.
I guess your work in or outside of people looking at sort of your career, Marg, has been the alignment that it takes with the farming industry, with forging community in that industry and particularly forging a place for women at that table, which is where the WA Women's Hall of Fame comes in. I mean, you were inducted in 2020 as the business inductee for your incredible work over your entire career. What was that like, being inducted into the WA Women's Hall of Fame?
Well, just to go back, I think starting off, I was absolutely moved and humbled. It wasn't my industry that actually nominated me. It was a local Esperance Chamber of Commerce and Industry. And I think that it was wonderful that just not my industry, but the local community understood what I had contributed So that meant a lot more to me than perhaps my own industry putting my name forward. I think it's just wonderful that agriculture's been recognised and is up there with across all career paths, yes.
The name of this podcast is Herstory, which is like history, but obviously taking a female-centric look. Is that a word that you've come across before?
No, no.
You got any thoughts on it?
Love it. I'm going to use it every day from now on. When I'm having a chat with a male friend, I'll say, now, this is Herstory. And that will shut them up because they'll be thinking about it and then I can do my spiel. So I like it. Thank you.
Before we let you go, Marg, do you listen to music when you're out on the tractor and that kind of
thing?
Oh,
gosh, yes.
What are you listening to?
Anything. When I'm in the shearing shed and I'm skirting the wool and classing it, I love good boppy music, you know, something that you keep your hands moving to. But sometimes the shearers don't have that sort of music. But on the whole, you know, something that, a bit like what you want to dance to, you know, something to keep you moving.
I'm just like having visions of you listening to some crazy drum and bass while shearing sheep now.
Yes.
Yeah.
I guess just one thing I've thought of is farmers today and how we work each day, and we have to be nimble. Like, it isn't like you go into the office and, okay, we'll do emails and service. There's a lot of things out of our control, marketing, interest rates, tariffs on our products. You know, now we've got COVID, and so we can't control that. We've got to be aware of it, but our day-to-day operation is being nimble, adaptive, that's the word. But I am also, I'd like to just have the opportunity to say I am in awe and admiration, and I'm being really sincere about the next generation of farmers. They're probably better educated. They are more worldly. They're more aware of what's happening overseas. They've travelled overseas, and collectively they're applying new technologies. They know how to use technology. The soil is in a far better healthy space. The products, their production is increasing even with our dry years. And I know I'm biased, but having been involved for decades, I think this generation is the most motivated and they're moving forward, and I'm really excited about where agriculture will be.
Oh, I'm so excited. You just made me feel like I need to go and investigate this entire
industry. But I'm sorry, I've got goosebumps. I'm like, my husband still works. For someone that wanted to sell, he still works at seeding time, which is winter, and he still drives a header during harvest. So we visit friends, and I drive by all the way home, I'll be looking. But really, you know, we just see so much improvement and the sincerity of the farmers. And, you know, with that has created wealth, so they've bought, you know, more farms. But that takes a huge amount of management, and at this time with labour. But they're getting around it. Of course, we are being watched by satellites, by the social media, by communities, by people driving past. We always have been conscious of looking after our animals and our soil, but more so now. And we can tick boxes. Like, if I was audited tomorrow, I've recorded, you know, everything I've done, which I don't have a problem with. We've taken in our stride because we've got our own responsibility, but we have a responsibility to the manufacturers and to the consumers.
Do you get into bed at night now and you just take a breath and go, oh, it's going to be all right? This next generation have got it covered.
Yes. I always have. And I think people have said to me, oh, you've got to adapt to climate change. I think we've adapted in all aspects of change. And so it's just second nature to us to adapt. It's hard, but there's research happening, and there's just a desire to, work with what we can't control.
Isn't that the grand irony? In one of the oldest traditions that is farming and sustaining and giving people life in food, one of the oldest traditions dating back as far as you can throw a rock, is one of the most adaptive industries.
Yes, and it is. And I've got the greatest confidence. And I just want to say to your listeners that, you know, be proud of our farmers and those involved in all aspects of agriculture, and they are adapting. It's challenging sometimes, especially when the things are out of our control, but we love what we do and we will continue to do it and do it better all the time.
Thanks to Marg Agnew and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Courtney Withers, Fiona Bartholomaeus and Sophie Minisale are our assistant producers. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses and artwork from Peter Roebuck. Zoe Zarziki also helped to edit this episode. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll catch you next week for episode 4.